This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Welcome to my podcast, The CRPS Compass, Navigating You Through Relief with Occupational Therapy. My name is Hannah Gregorio, an occupational therapy student with a passion for complex regional pain syndrome and how occupational therapy can play a role in management and support. Today is episode 9 of this podcast, and today I'm joined by Linda Crawford. Linda is a licensed OT with over 30 years of experience working in neuro rehab, seating and positioning, and is a pain rehab specialist. Linda was also the prior president of the Colorado Association of Occupational Therapy, is the owner of Brave Therapy, and a certified Daring Way facilitator. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Hi, Anna. I'm great. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. I'm super excited to talk more just about your experiences. So first, can you please share a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in working with the CRPS population as an OT?
Yeah, thanks so much, Hannah. Well, as you said, you know, I've had a few different specialties throughout my career. So long career in occupational therapy, profession that I absolutely love. And so my journey into working with people with complex pain conditions kind of happened. It wasn't planned, but I was hurt on the job in 2009. And unfortunately, I ended up in long-term chronic pain, and not from the injury from the job, but from a practitioner injury, believe it or not. And so, you know, after a year of doing all the therapies and everything they told me to do, they said, hey, we can't help you anymore. This is going to be your life. Now, I did not have CRPS. I did have chronic pain, though. But, you know, I could barely leave my house, and going to the grocery store would put me in bed for 2 days. And when they told me there's nothing more you could do, it hit me really hard, like it would anybody, right? Like, this is going to be your life. And it was then that I kind of had this aha that I had done everything except occupational therapy. I did physical therapy, massage therapy. I did all the stuff they told me to do, and I got worse and worse and worse. And I also recognized that as an occupational therapist, I had always believed for every single client I worked with that they could influence their health and have a better life. That was the basic philosophy of our profession. And that if I was going to believe what they told me, then none of that was true, right? It was like I couldn't throw that out the window. Like I could, like my deep core belief. And so that was the day that occupational therapy really, I recognized it was more than a job for me. It was an entire belief system, and it was part of my DNA. And so I kind of took control, if you will, of my own journey of recovery from pain from that point on, and did like most research you can imagine. When it's personal, you're going to look for everything you can learn and everything you can do. And so I ended up finding a really great physical therapy who had specialist training in my area. And then I discovered pain neuroscience, which was back then, it was kind of still new and not talked about very much. And I also began to recognize some things about my own body, right? When we are occupational therapists, we do look at everything, our whole life, our physical function, our senses, our emotions. And I started recognizing some emotions that were triggering my pain, specifically shame. I'm not good enough. I lost like my ability to work, my ability to do stuff around the house, even cook dinner, you know, all those losses. And then there was also some shame in the medical world put on me, like you're faking it. And I think a lot of people in long-term pain experience that from not from medical professionals, from family members, from people in the community, just really don't understand what that experience is like when pain doesn't let up day after day after day, and they don't know how to support you. So I did so much research, Hannah. I spent years figuring out how to apply it to myself. And so it took me a few years after that gradually getting better and also embracing that I had to do things that were meaningful for me, those activities I'd given up, grading back into them. I know we're going to talk about graded motor imagery. That was a technique. And my certified Brené Brown training, that was part of the emotional mental health pieces. And so it all came together and I became pain-free. I didn't expect that. I just was trying to get better enough to have a better life. But I became pain-free in 2014, so over 10 years now. I'm excited.
Congratulations.
And I've been able to do things that they said I never would be able to do. So what happened at that, right about close to that turning point, is I was invited to join a practice doing occupational therapy with men and women with long-term pelvic pain, which was a specialty. So I specialized in that. And then clients with CRPS started showing up. And I recognized that the treatments that they were getting weren't as holistic as what we do in occupational therapy, looking at all the pieces, not individual parts, and just treating them. And so I became really interested in helping those folks, because certainly that is the most painful long-term pain condition you could have. Most my clients had tried just about everything by the time they came to me. I only saw people with very complex pain conditions who maybe their physicians or therapists told them they failed too, like they told me, right? We don't know what else to do. So that list led me on a journey, and I feel like I hold those clients very close to my heart that I worked with that had CRPS, because I've become very involved in their personal life too. And with my own personal experience, I can really empathize. So that's kind of how it led to that.
Wow, that is absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Next question, you've completed extensive work looking at acceptance and commitment therapy. Can you just share what acceptance and commitment therapy specifically entails and how it can benefit individuals with CRPS?
Yeah, I think it's just really a great therapy framework for us, because it's mindfulness-based, it's compassion and self-compassionate-based. And so we know from research too that mindfulness practices help calm our nervous system. They can have an impact on calming pain. They're all connected. So acceptance and commitment therapy kind of gives us a really great framework to be able to experience what we're experiencing without judgment, to be kind of, you know, I mean, you can imagine how difficult that is when you're in pain, but we can kind of find a way to step back a little bit, if you will, especially with the mindfulness practices, and say, okay, what is going on? And how can I know what I need in this moment, maybe? And to kind of accept what we're going through. As hard as that may sound, actually, when you practice it, it's not that difficult to get into that practice and work on it. So there's some different aspects of it. There's exploring what are your personal values. So it's very individual based, which is great. What are your values that guide you in life? How can you be present in the moment and focus on the here and now and not the past or the future and the worries, you know, and the what ifs and the catastrophizing we do, that kind of thing? How do we create space for our thoughts and feelings? And that's a safe space. How do we make it safe to have our feelings, to even validate ourselves, to have that self-compassion practice like we would be compassionate to someone else? Can we give that to ourselves? Hey, you're okay. You know, I'm going to care for you. And one of the things that parts of acceptance and commitment therapy that I thought really connected, especially to occupational therapy practice, is self as context. because as occupational therapists, we look at context, meaning environments, like where are you? How does that affect you? Who are you with? How does that affect you? But what about ourself as an environment, I guess, if you will? And when I had conversations with my clients about this, and for me personally, my body and myself wasn't safe, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was in pain. So it was really difficult to feel safe in my body, in my emotions, and like as a context, how is the environment of myself, which entails everything about me and how I feel about my body and everything, how do we create a safe space there to explore? Because when we're trying to work through a pain experience, and this is not true just for pain, I will say, when we're trying to work through a difficult, challenging experience, no matter what it is, if we can find that safe space to explore it, then we have the opportunity to hear and listen to things that maybe we've been trying to avoid. When we're in pain, we try not to feel our body. We try not to feel, you know, and we have to embrace those feelings. We have to kind of hug them back to us, right? And what do I need? And that leads to this power that we often don't know we can tap into with self-regulation. Because when we do that, we get great brain chemicals released, natural opioids, natural painkillers in our brain. We calm our nervous system, which we know is very involved in the whole responsiveness, particularly with CRPS. So I just think it's a great framework to integrate into every kind of care for people and to explore. And it's been validated that practicing acceptance and commitment therapy and engaging in it does have a positive effect on painful experience.
I love that. Thank you for sharing more about that. What role does mental health and emotional well-being play in managing CRPS, and how can OTs incorporate that in their treatments with CRPS patients?
Oh, we can't not, okay? Because we're not, it's so funny how we like to try and chop up, okay, psychological's over here, physical's over here, social's, I mean, we're humans. So, you know, we can't separate anything. And so I have a favorite saying to try and make sense of it is to say, all biography, meaning entire lived experience at any given moment, affects your bio.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
So all biography is biology. Everything is going to affect your physiological, your emotional, everything, environment, social, everything affects it. So again, we can't separate any of it. And oh my gosh, being in long-term pain, the challenges there are extraordinary. I'll tell you a quick story too that really hit home with me with a client. I saw a client who was 22 hours in bed every day for pain. Not a CRPS client, but she could have been, because that's not uncommon with CRPS. And so I saw her in her home. And the first time I saw her in her home, and we sat on her couch, and she's sitting in a chair in the living room, and she's telling me her story. And she said, I had breast cancer. And when I had breast cancer, I got a pink ribbon. Everybody brought me food. People gave me rides. I had a support group. I had places to go, and people were always there for me through the entire process of recovery, of retreatment and recovery. And then she looked at me and she said, "Where's my ribbon for this? Where's my ribbon for this pain experience?" She said, "Nobody calls me. Nobody brings me food. My friends don't want to talk about it anymore or hear from me anymore." And it still gets me choked up, because it did then, because this is the reality of any long-term pain experience for a person experience is that struggle of, we don't have communities of care. We don't have a society that understands that pain can go on. It's not a person's fault. We connect shame to it. We think with painkillers it should go away, or you're faking it. Or, I mean, there's just horrible things. And then again, these are the bravest warriors that we have, and they don't have that support. So mental health is so important. We need to create communities of care. People need to find those communities of care and people who are going to support them. And we can help as therapists with the mindfulness practices, it's got to be safe to feel your body and also feel your emotions and get through them. And I think that my training with Brené Brown's work was shame resilience and self-compassion and vulnerability and moving towards guideposts for wholehearted living, like following your values and who you are. It kind of helped give me a framework to work with people, to talk, have conversations. And honestly, one of the best things we can do is to validate and support. Listen, validate, and support, and not be fixers, right? But support people, so critical. And we also know another thing is, we know in long-term upregulation of the sympathetic nervous system, lots of adrenaline and cortisol in our bodies, our brains reduce the production of our natural opioids, our oxytocin, our endorphins. So depression can be more biological than emotional in that case, because the biology of the body has changed in long-term pain conditions to make people more susceptible to having more struggles with that. And it all makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And kind of going into our next question, obviously mindfulness is talked so much in OT. How does mindfulness help people with chronic pain conditions like CRPS? And what are ways that patients can incorporate it into their daily lives?
Yeah, I love this question, because I think there's different perspectives on mindfulness and how to use mindfulness. So there's mindfulness practices and there's mindfulness meditations, but mindfulness really is about learning to be present in any given situation. So a mindfulness meditation can be helpful, but that's not a long-term change practice. I mean, it can help you over time, yes, but we've got to be able to have that ability to self-regulate in the moment, if you will. And so, and in the moment, learning the skills of mindfulness in the moment can be really powerful. So one of the ways I found that in my own recovery was, you know, I was trying to get more physically active, right, as I was starting to feel better. But boy, that was really scary, really scary, because you get so hyper-focused on your body sensations. Going out for a walk again, so walking was incredibly painful for me. And I wanted to start walking and, you know, doing it very slowly and gradually. But what would happen is I would start to walk and all I could think about is, am I okay? What's my body doing? I'm so tuned into it. And that hypervigilance upregulates our nervous system. It makes, we got cortisol, but I'm not going to do well. My pain's not going to get better. So learning mindfulness was like, okay, I'm going to take care of myself through this walking. I'm safe. You know, I have to tell myself I'm safe, because I'm going to take care of myself and we're just going to do what we can. And I'm not going to focus on my body. I'm not going to be so hypervigilant that I caused this increased awareness and this increased response. And so I would go out and intentionally switch my attention to the sky, the clouds, the birds I'm hearing, all the other senses that I could embrace, but also that gave me joy in being outside and those kind of things. So that was a very powerful mindfulness practice for me to gradually get better. And then there's other ones that I would work with clients on called beauty minutes, like just stopping and just looking around. It doesn't matter where you are, find something. You could take a picture, you could just look at it differently, find some kind of beauty in it. Think about that. It can be kind of almost a distraction, but it also, you get good brain chemicals from doing those kind of things. And it gives you gratitude. And we know gratitude is very powerful as well. So I think the most important thing, though, with mindfulness is the way it connects to the acceptance and commitment therapy processes of self as context, because interoception, okay, the sensory sense of your body sensations, right? They're not safe, particularly when you have CRPS, because so many crazy things happen in your body. And so feeling those doesn't feel safe. But mindfulness practices connected to self as making self as context a safe place gives us that opportunity in any experience. So when there's a pain flare, can we take a break? It's kind of like hit the pause button, right? What's going on? Take a step back. First, validating, I'm okay. I'm going to help myself. And how can I care for myself and listen and go that way? The thing that I discovered for myself and all my clients that I worked with discovered too is that the only way is through to get to a different outcome, right? And so you have to make that safe. And then you have to prioritize caring for yourself, asking for what you need, empowering. So I always felt like the clients I worked with, a lot of the work was empowering, right? Understanding what this process you can go through, but then you can make choices to take care of yourself or ask for what you need. And that makes a huge difference.
So another intervention that OTs really focus on, and I feel like, especially in pain rehab, this is a huge topic of discussion, is graded motor imagery. Can you share just about graded motor imagery and how it plays a role in managing chronic pain?
Sure, absolutely. So graded motor imagery was developed by the NOI group in Australia. So if you Google it, that's what you'll find. I think I might be the first OT that was trained by them in the U.S. way back by Tim Beams, who wrote the clinical chapter, and Robert Johnson. But I will tell you, I had a different perspective, and I brought different ideas to it when we were training and learning. And Robert Johnson came to me at one point and he said, "We need you in this because you are seeing things and integrating it in a way that the other physical therapists were focused differently, because we're occupational therapists. We're thinking about everything, the environment, the sensory, the emotions, the stuff, right?" So I will tell you that I added all of this experience. Plus, I came from a neuro background, okay? So I had this background for many, many years, specializing, working with people with brain injury, acquired brain injuries, and stroke rehab and other neurological conditions. And so this was not a new idea to me, that you can work with the neuroplasticity of our brains to help make changes. But I will say I never did it the traditional way I was taught. And now I don't know how other people do it, but I didn't. And I will tell you, it worked tremendously well, particularly with my clients with CRPS, because I adapted it and did it to fit them and individual. So it also combined with mindfulness practices. So for example, if you're familiar with graded motor imagery, you know it's kind of a progression where you do implicit imagery, where you're just looking at magazines or whatever of pictures of maybe the body part. I will say hands and feet are the most typical to be affected. So, and then you kind of progress to right-left discrimination, looking at pictures of the body part on a program and answering if it's right or left. And then you can also, you can go to mirror therapy, and then explicit imagery is actually imagining you're doing an activity going forward. So obviously I learned this when I was in pain, applied it to myself as well. So I had my own experience. And so I will tell you, I really adapted. So one of the things they would teach in the graded motor imagery training, right, is you look at the speed when you're doing right-left discrimination activities and the errors and stuff like that. Well, we didn't do that because my clients with CRPS, it was so threatening to their system to look, to even look at these hands. I had one client who, when she looked at some of the hand pictures, she saw clown hands, not all of them, but some of they were all swollen and big fingers and all distorted to her because that's her perception of her body. And so for her to even look at a picture, she'd get stressed out and anxious. So we adapted it based on that response. It was, how do we downgrade it to until you feel safe? We don't care how long it takes. We don't care what it, you know, just look at the picture until it's safe. And then we progress from there. And so we would adapt everything, the mirror therapy. And again, like things like mirror therapy, right, left discrimination, those elements, people have to practice anything that you're trying to work on neuroplasticity. There has to be a lot of practice. So my clients went home with mirrors, their own mirrors. You can't just do it in the clinic one or two times a week and expect anything to happen. So they went home with mirrors and practiced at home when they were doing mirror therapy. And again, grading everything. I think it's a great program to integrate if you integrate it, put it that way. I had clients, again, I saw clients who tried everything. And so I had clients who'd done mirror therapy and GMI with other therapists before they came to me, but they weren't doing it in a way that was adapted to where they were at. And they weren't getting enough gradual grading of it and practice, if you will, to move forward. And so it didn't work for them because of the way it was done, more in a medical model, I guess, kind of treatment method. But this is where I think occupational therapists have a great opportunity to integrate it into the holistic practice. Definitely. So one of the things I think I told you, Hannah, before we talked about this is every client I worked with CRPS went into remission, every single one. And I've had people who don't believe that, that it's true, that that happened. I've had physicians tell me they worked with people for 30 years and never seen one person go into remission. And so I just said there must be something in this amount of things that we're doing and the way we're doing it with these people that, and these are people, again, who have tried everything. And it had just progressed and progressed and progressed. And they'd been years with it. Some brand new, but some years. So I think it's how you do all of these things, including graded motor imagery, in individualizing with the person what works through them. I had a physician tell me one time when I described how I worked with my clients, he said, you lead by following. And I said, yes, exactly right. I'm listening all the time. And we don't go forward until we hear you're forward. I don't have expectations that something's supposed to happen a certain way because it's up to that person to figure it out and experiment and work with me. And I give insight and we move forward and do it that way. And I think that kind of helped make the difference there. So I think it's really important. I'm actually going to be teaching a workshop on this at the Colorado conference in September on how to do graded motor imagery in an innovative way that meets people where they're at. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's so exciting. I'm glad that you brought that portion up, really focusing on the patient and the progress at basically where they're at in that moment. I feel like as health professionals, at times you can just be like, the goal is to get this person better. But at times we can maybe forget that they're going through all this pain. I feel like we just need to take a pause and be like, hold on. Like, let's just take a break, really check in with how our patient's doing. Because at the end of the day, I mean, it's their life. And as occupational therapists, we're treating the whole person. And I think it's so important, and it's such a good reminder just as healthcare professionals that we really need to be putting our patients first. So yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's what can set us apart as occupational therapy practitioners though, too, is that we can co-create plans instead mm-hmm. of being prescribers, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the medical model is prescription-based, but we really are that profession that we want to co-create with our clients, because we're integrating. We're the integrators of everything into real life with people, you know? So we have to co-create. When I would first work with clients and we'd sit down, I would say, here's what I come with. I come with a lot of training and a lot of knowledge of evidence of techniques and also my own personal experience. I have all this and I know all this science stuff, but we don't know the science of you. And that's what we're going to do. And that's how we work together. I bring this. You're the expert of you. Let's figure out together how what I bring works with you and how we go forward. So absolutely. And we need to embrace that. Our unique difference in practitioners. Now, I will say there are limits sometimes depending on the setting you're working in, right? That's a challenge. That's why I went into private practice. I would just say great opportunities there. People are looking for more quality of care than they maybe can receive in clinic-based. So I went into private practice. I was in an office, and then I went to community-based. And so I only saw people in their home, which was way more effective, because then you get to see their real life. You get to sit down with their families, everything. You can change environments because you're there. So that was the most effective. So lots of opportunity for anybody interested in going that route.
Another big topic that OTs focus on is sensory processing. And as we know, when it comes to pain, all of our sensory processing is affected by pain. Can you just talk about how sensory processing can play a role in CRPS, and what can we do as OTs to improve sensory processing?
Yeah, absolutely. So talking about the general things, CRPS affects neuroimmune system, endocrine system, everything's reactive, right? But all of us, we're always reacting to sensory input mm-hmm. all the time. We're feeling things or not feeling things, whatever. So I discovered pretty early in my private practice that we needed to start integrating this, because environments, like you would hear people tell stories like, oh, I can't go to restaurants anymore because it's too loud. And then my pain goes up, or, you know, lights are too bright or whatever it is. So I started doing a sensory symptom checklist with my clients. I didn't want to diagnose them with a sensory processing issue by using the adult and adolescent sensory profile. You can do that. I will say Bronnie Lennox Thompson validated that assessment for mm-hmm. use with people with pain, but I didn't want to diagnose. I just wanted to do like an exploration. And so I used that sensory checklist. We also did another checklist that was a sensory diet, just to like, what calms you, yeah. what, you know, so we could kind of get, mm-hmm. but the sensory symptom checklist went through the different sensory systems, the 8 sensory systems, and we got to have conversations like, what was it like when you're a baby? And what's like, so I ask family members and get a whole lot of information that then helped the person to understand why they were the way they were. And then I also did it with family members, because they can have different sensory stuff, and then that can become conflicts. Like, one person likes the lights bright, but the person with pain, that's too much. And then they're fighting, or that's too loud. And they don't, you know what I mean? They don't understand each other, and that there's certain sensory profiles. So it was really helpful for individuals to kind of get this aha about their bodies and not try to work against it. Like, oh, I should be able to handle that. Right. And it's like, no, you're really wired this way. It's important for you to know that so you can make choices. One of the big ahas for my clients was vestibular sensory processing, being slightly over or under responsive. And so what we found, we typically tell people, well, you have to take breaks and take rests, right? Guess what? People who are under responsive vestibular, now this wasn't a research project, but it would be a great research project for somebody to do, but this is what I found with my clients. The ones who were under responsive if they had to sit on the couch and lay on the couch and rest, they were in the most distress and the most pain.
Wow.
Because they're not regulated. Mm. They need vestibular input, right? Mm. To feel that green area, that calm, that place where they feel normal. They were the ones who couldn't stand it. So, and they were also the ones who tended to overdo, and you had to pull them back. Hmm. So there are clients who typically would do too much and have to pull back. And then they were the over responsive people who didn't want to get off the couch. And I had a client who, she was afraid to reach out and pick up a glass of water because it would trigger her back pain. She was afraid to open a cabinet door or a car door. And her sensory exploration checklist showed she's always been over responsive to vestibular input. She hated stuff. So then that person doesn't want, it's really hard to get them motivated to try stuff. They're very fearful of movement. So it really showed for that sensory kind of exploration, the big difference, and that one size doesn't fit all. And some of my clients would say, well, everybody keeps telling me to go to those float things where there's no sensory input. And my one client said, she goes, I went there and I hated it. I'm like, of course you did. I would hate it too, because I'm like you. She's an under-responsive vestibular person. You take all that sensory stuff away. So it gives us a lot of good information, gives the clients information. That's just a couple examples, but I would highly recommend exploring that with clients and families. Like, they can start having conversation and understanding how you can design your environments and your lives, and why my husband in particular had to learn why I couldn't go to restaurants when I was in pain. Mm. The noise and the light, they don't bother me now. But when I was in pain, our tolerance for that changes as well. So it's to be expected. So yeah, super important. Great question.
I love that you included the family members when you were assessing the patients. I mean, just so important, because I mean, at the end of the day, family members, they're a part of that person's life and they're crucial. That's so neat. Very cool.
I can tell you another story particularly about that is, so this one client, they had a couple of kids, young kids, elementary school kids, and the husband, he worked in an emergency room. He was like director of nursing at the emergency room. So think about that environment, being in that environment, working all day. And so interestingly enough, when he did his sensory exploration, he was actually very sensitive to noise. And it was a big aha for both of them, because what would happen is when he would come home, and if the kids would start making noise, he was like on edge. Mm-hmm. But once he got home, he needed that quiet space to self-regulate. So if the kids were yelling or screaming, he was like, And it gave them an ability to understand why he reacted that way, which then affected my client too, right? The mom and the kids and the whole thing. And guess what? They got to work out some strategies in their household, for their family, for everybody that worked. You reduce the stress in the family, in the home life, from that one simple thing. That's going to make a huge difference for the person who's experiencing pain.
Yeah. I love that. Wow. Thank you for sharing. So you did just mention a few assessment tools that you can use for sensory. What are some other assessment tools that you would recommend using while working with this population?
Yeah. So, I mean, you do all your standard assessments, right? Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people prefer the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure as the main one. So I'm just going to add a few more. I mean, definitely interview. Think about any assessment or questionnaire. It should be connected to a conversation. Don't like just give something and read it, and you know, because you find out so much more about the story when you ask questions when you're going through something. So the PSEQ, the pain self-efficacy questionnaire, can be really, really valuable and helpful, because it gives you information about where are they at in believing that they can affect their pain experience. And it can also be a great outcome measure. I always gave at some point, not again, you don't always do these all right away. You kind of, as you going through your relationship and you figure out when's a good time, the Kristen Neff self-compassion test, which is online, and that is validated for research. That also can be validated for an outcome measure. And it connects all the elements of self-compassion, and mindfulness is one of those. So you can actually get a score on somebody's mindfulness practice, but you also get, you get the scores on over-identification and isolation and other thing factors that influence a client's experience and what. And it also, there's lots of exercises and there's a lot of neuroscience behind the practice of self-compassion can help modulate pain in our experience. So that education, that's like a core skill, is saying, you know, I'm going to care for myself. I'm going to give myself compassion, not beat myself up, so that we can then practice all these other skills that we're trying to develop to take care of ourselves and get better. Mm-hmm. So, and then I would also do a fear avoidance hierarchy. So I use that kind of as a goal setting tool as well, because it gave people the opportunity to identify activities that were important to them, write down what are their beliefs about it, about doing it. Like, you know, I had a client who, she was afraid that she's going to get a big pain flare from doing something. And then they rate, like, how much fear do you have about doing this and how much do you avoid it? And so it gives you two measures, not just I'm not doing it. And then you can, as you go through the program, you can revisit it. And so I had a client with CRPS at one point where she was so sensitive, you couldn't even touch her. She would faint. Couldn't touch her. Yeah. So hers had developed a long way. So she had a lot of activities on there. And some of them were way far out, like she wanted to be able to ride a bike again. And we started with this, and it gave her a framework too to work towards. And then we would revisit it every so often. And then she'd get to see, oh yeah, I don't have as much fear. And then the avoidance would go down. And then I'd try it. And then, and everything went to zero after about 6 months, which was really amazing. You know, she went into remission. So, but she did the work too. In addition to, we talked about doing some kind of sensory and the other things. So those are the main ones I would kind of throw out there.
Great. Thank you. Can you share about what being a certified Daring Way facilitator entails and how the program can assist OTs with working in pain rehab?
So I will say I'm kind of a unicorn there. Brené, if people are familiar with Brené Brown's work, she's really well known now. Back when I first discovered her, when I was in pain, I recognized that her work was going to be really helpful for me personally in my recovery process. And then she opened up facilitator training, and it wasn't open to occupational therapists. And I wrote to them and said, hey, here's all my training. Because they had to, you had to be, with your license, you had to be able to do psychoeducational work, which we do, which we know. I said, hey, here's my training. And they said, no. And I wrote back to them again, and they said, no. So I wrote back the third time. And they said yes, and they added occupational therapy to the professionals that could be trained. So this is back in 2013 or so. So she did training for a number of years, and then she closed training. So it hasn't been open for a long time. So she's not training any more people. And so there are those of us who are still there in the community and still keeping up our certification, and we have access to her research, her training. We have curricular materials that we can lead people through. I will say it's profoundly helped me personally. And so then it also helps me with the clients I work with. Sometimes I do some of the exercises. I have done small groups leading people through some of the curriculum before, particularly with women. So it informs me a lot. I think studying her work can be really beneficial. I would say the most beneficial thing is what it did for me, because it made me a better practitioner.
That's great.
I feel the most authentically living, like who I am, and work through some of my stuff, right? And so I feel like it allows me to be the most genuine, open, caring person that I can be with clients that I work with. So, and to help them find that for themselves. So there's a lot there you can draw from.
Yeah.
I think it's, like I said, she's not training any more people. So there's a few of us out here, a few occupational therapists left still who are certified. And I'm really grateful that I had that opportunity and that experience.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that you can still implement that what you've learned into your practice today. You have that expertise that not everybody has, and that's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, like I think I told you in the beginning, shame was a big part that I recognized in my pain experience that would make my pain go up. So, you know, learning shame resilience skills for myself, but then helping my clients.
Yeah.
Like,
so important.
Like, even in a client therapeutic relationship, often our clients are trying to please us. And if they don't do their exercises, they feel shame.
Right.
Like, I didn't meet, and it's like, no, there's no shame. There's no shaming. We adapt everything.
Yep.
Nothing's perfection, you know, letting go of perfectionism and just helping people through that process. So powerful. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. As an OT who works in the pain rehab setting, what is some advice that you could give to OTs looking to work in this setting?
Yeah. So first I'll say I am retired from practice. So I'm no longer actively practicing. However, I have still, like, I've mentored four capstone students. The last three, we worked on developing a pain self-management program that is offered through our state association, a training. We do a certification training program and a curriculum they get. So I still work in kind of in mentorship, I will say, and support, and hoping the next, you guys, you next generation, you're going to pick it up and go way farther. So that's exciting. So, but I will say, you know, advice, you got to study, you got to find a mentor. Go outside OT, PT, go to interdisciplinary pain conferences, meet people from all over the world, learn from your clients, and co-create with people. Recognize, you know, you can't fix people. You got to be patient, give people time. I will say the most important thing that my clients told me that I gave them was a safe space. They could be like, tell me, hey, I hate therapy. And I'm like, yeah, of course you do. You're tired of it. Go take a vacation. You know, you need that more than you need therapy right now. Stuff like that, right? You know, it's like, make a safe space and recognize that, just like everything. I mean, I'll say pain is individual, but really everything. We're all individuals. And we're there to kind of help people find the puzzle of themselves and put pieces that fit together. Yeah, be patient. And it's a real calling, because you want to make space. Working with people with long-term pain, people need that empathetic, safe space.
Yeah, thank you. Our last question. What have been some of your primary takeaways while working in pain rehab and with CRPS as a healthcare professional?
I will say, I think the clients I worked with CRPS were the most rewarding relationships that I had because... they're very personal to me. You know, I could feel their experience goes beyond really other people's experience. And I've been to some CRPS conferences and met people who they're just looking for a fix. You know, when we're in pain that long, you want somebody to fix you. But you also don't want to hear that it's going to take a long process, you know. And this is the challenge for us as therapists is how do we help somebody buy in, if you will, and trust us that going through this process that we can do with them, that's slower, that's very much more connected to interoception and mindfulness and holistic and looking at everything and how can you learn what your body needs? They don't hear that from most everybody else. And so I think it can be a challenge for us to be different like that. But it's so much what people need is for somebody to be different and that supportive person and to challenge too, like go to conferences and challenge some of the, take the things you learn and then OT them. I think back to that client who said, where's my ribbon? Honestly, that kept me focused for years with every person I worked with in pain, because I realized this person doesn't have a ribbon for what they're going through. Can we give that to them in this therapy relationship and help them develop their community of support and care?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and just sharing about your knowledge as an OT who worked in pain rehab and talking about acceptance and commitment therapy and graded motor imagery and the role of sensory processing. It's been a pleasure. So thank you so much, Linda, for your time.
Thank you, Hannah, for asking. I appreciate it.